Today is Monday, November 30th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, Ethiopian refugees say the federal military is blocking them from reaching safety in Sudan.
From the perspective of the refugees in the camp, they think the federal government is blocking the accessing for the Sudanese borders.
Also ahead, protests in France against police brutality.
The main protest was on Saturday here in Paris. Some 46,000 people took to the streets.
Plus, charges in New Zealand over a deadly volcanic eruption. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Ethiopia, where Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has claimed victory over the Tigray People's Liberation Front after capturing the Tigray capital Mekele over the weekend. But the leader of Tigray's forces said they were still fighting, raising fears of a protracted guerrilla conflict. The nearly month-long war has killed hundreds and probably thousands, sent refugees into Sudan, affected a peacekeeping mission in Somalia, and deepened divisions among Ethiopia's ethnic groups. Though the Tigray capital Mekele, with 500,000 people, fell with little resistance, the TPLF later said it had shot down a military plane, retaken one town, and was resisting. TPLF leader Debretsion Gebremichael denied reports that he had fled to South Sudan and said his forces had captured some soldiers from neighboring Eritrea around Wukro, about 50 kilometers north of Mekele. Gebremichael told Reuters via text message, quote, "I'm close to Mekele in Tigray, fighting the invaders," end quote. By telephone, he told the Associated Press that the TPLF is confident of victory. However, Abiy said his forces know where the TPLF leadership is hiding and is planning to capture them. Claims from all sides are difficult to verify since phone and internet links to Tigray have largely been cut and access has been tightly controlled since the war began. Abiy on Monday told Parliament there were no civilian casualties in the recapture of Mekele.
99% target metanal, 99%.
Abiy says, quote, "We were on target 99%. There was no collateral damage on 99% of the operation," end quote. He said the military used drones to ensure they were not firing on civilians. Abiy again. He says, quote, "The defense forces never killed a single person in a single town," end quote. Abiy added that no soldier from any country could display better competence. However, the International Committee of the Red Cross said in a press release Sunday that the Eider Referral Hospital in Mekele was running short on body bags for the dead. The ICRC said roughly 80% of patients at the hospital were suffering from trauma injuries. The Red Cross's head of operations in Ethiopia said, quote, "The hospital is running dangerously low on sutures, antibiotics, anticoagulants, painkillers, and even gloves," end quote. In neighboring Sudan, new arrivals of refugees from Tigray have slowed to a trickle. Journalist Naba Mohiddin is in the Sudanese town of Al-Ghadarif near the border camps for Ethiopian refugees. She says that refugees have told her that the reason fewer people are crossing the border is because the Ethiopian military is blocking them. I spoke to Mohiddin earlier today, and here is a clip of our conversation. Naba, the new arrivals of refugees in Sudan is slowing down. Can you tell us what's happening?
Yeah, the number of refugees is decreasing every day. Sudanese authorities notice that the numbers are not exceeding 700 per day, compared to 3,000 per day before last Thursday, before the last attack on Tigray capital. The authorities say the attack on the Tigray capital affected the crossing of the refugees to Sudanese borders. Also, the Ethiopian army, there is some reports say the Ethiopian army blocked the road that leading to Sudanese borders, and some of the borders in Sudan lands are also crossed by Sudanese police and security and military. So the numbers are decreasing every day, and people in the camps are getting so worried about their families because they lost contacts with them after the last news of the attack on the Tigray capital. there is no internet connection, so people cannot get touch with their families.
You mentioned reports of Ethiopia's military blocking people from reaching Sudan. Why are they doing this?
From the perspective of the refugees in the camp, they think the federal government is blocking the accessing for the Sudanese borders, the Ethiopian borders leading to Sudan. They are surrounding the refugees because they think they are bound to TPLF, and they already gave them time to leave the Tigray region. So everybody didn't leave at that time. He's considered as TPLF. This is why accessing to Sudan right now is harder from the perspective of the refugees.
And now let's look at the Sudanese authorities. Why are they deploying forces on the border with Ethiopia?
Sudanese government say they are making a new camp to make it bigger for refugees that are arriving. They reported that the number is decreasing. In the same time, they closed some borders as it's very close to towns and cities where smugglers were active for years. So right now they are concerned about an active network for crime like smuggling and human trafficking. They are watching the borders. They are not banning anyone to enter Sudan if he or she succeeded in entering Sudan, but the numbers are decreasing as they are securing the borders and making new camps for refugees.
When you and I spoke last week, you said refugees told you about attacks on civilians by the Ethiopian federal government. The few people who have arrived since then, have they also reported such atrocities?
The last reports I heard about civilians, and some people succeeded in getting touch with their families. I met few new arrivals. They said right now everybody is targeted, whether he's a civilian or military. So the last allegations I hear that they just attacked everyone, civilians, people who tried to cross the borders, or military, TPLF troops. So they think right now it's the war of everyone against everyone. This is the last thing I heard, and I met new arrivals saying it's getting more worse on attacking on people and the killing on the street.
And can you share some more about these refugees who you've met recently? Who are they, and what specifically have they told you about what they saw in Ethiopia?
I talked to an old man. He came with his 11-year-old son. He was trying to cross, and he said they killed his son and he couldn't even bury him. And he's carrying his small photo with him and crying the whole way till he hardly reached Sudan. And I also met a 14-year-old child. He was a recently arrival with two or three of his family members. He said they entered their house and they found a military uniform belongs to his brother. And once they saw the uniform, they threatened them with a knife and they let them leave the place. And they could hardly survive and reach to the borders. And he said right now he cannot sleep. He's seeing nightmares every day of the bodies being thrown in the way, and some of his neighbors were killed with knives and axes. And he cannot forget the faces of the military individuals and officers who were screaming on him and his family. But he felt so lucky to be alive and to reach Sudan.
That was journalist Naba Mohideen in the Sudanese town of Gadarif near the border camps for Ethiopian refugees. She was speaking to me earlier today. There has not been any immediate comment from the Ethiopian government on reports that its military is blocking refugees from escaping to Sudan. Now we head to Iran, which held a funeral service Monday for nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh at an outdoor area of Iran's defense ministry in Tehran, with officials in attendance. Iran's defense minister said at the funeral that the killing would make Iranians more united and more determined. He also criticized countries that hadn't condemned the slaying, warning, quote, "This will catch up with you someday," end quote. Overnight, United Arab Emirates, which has just reached a normalization deal with Israel, issued a statement condemning the, quote, "heinous assassination," end quote. Meanwhile, a top Iranian security official says Israel used electronic devices to remotely kill the scientist. AP correspondent Charles Della Desma reports.
The remark from the secretary of the country's Supreme National Security Council drastically changes the story of the Friday slaying of the nuclear scientist. Authorities initially said a truck exploded and then gunmen opened fire. A state TV Arabic language channel claims the weapons used were controlled by satellite, a claim also made Sunday by the semi-official Fars news agency. None of the outlets immediately offered any evidence supporting their claims. Israel has declined to comment on the attack. I'm Charles de la Desma.
For more on what the killing may mean for the region, International Edition's Steve Miller spoke to Middle East and North Africa analyst Emily Hawthorne at Stratfor, a rain company, via Skype. Here is a clip of their conversation.
I think the big takeaway is that Israel is really accelerating its strategy of trying to weaken Iran's nuclear program, which is something that Israel has done for a long period of time, for many years before now. But I think just over the last year, we've seen an intensified Israeli effort to do so. And I think that that does mean there's a risk of escalation between Israel and Iran, but also a risk of escalation between the U.S. and Iran. And if and when that happens, everyone in the region will get caught in between that. So I think that's why you're seeing a lot of voices in the region, countries like the United Arab Emirates calling for calm, trying to make sure that this situation doesn't turn into an Iranian retaliation that turns into a big tit for tat. But we have to wait and see what happens.
Emily, Iran has blamed Israel for Fakhrizadeh's death and has promised to retaliate. But this is coming in the waning days of the Trump administration and before January 20th, when President-elect Joe Biden will be sworn in. Now, since Biden was part of the Obama administration that crafted the 2015 nuclear deal, does that play into how Tehran responds?
Iran has promised retaliation, and that makes perfect sense, but it could take months and years. And in fact, President Rouhani has called for strategic patience. And other Iranian officials are of course, calling for a swifter response against Israel. But you're going to see this really, this debate within Iran about how to respond, how quickly. You're going to see it play out in the presidential elections in Iran over the next year. And it's really going to determine exactly how that sort of domestic debate is going to determine whether or not Iran and the U.S. can enter any sort of nuclear deal. And that is something that is of interest to every single country in the region, because the primary conflict here is between Iran and Israel. And that's a long-standing, decades-long dispute in the region. But every country in between them and in the broader area, they all are vulnerable to any sort of escalation from that conflict. So everyone is watching and waiting to see whether any de-escalation can happen between those two countries and between Iran and the United States.
That's Emily Hawthorne, a Middle East and North Africa analyst at Stratfor, a rain company, speaking to International Edition's Steve Miller. French President Emmanuel Macron's government says it will revise but not redraft a proposed security law that would place limits on citizens filming police. This comes after massive and sometimes violent protests rocked the European nation over the weekend. Those protests were prompted by the release of video showing police officers assaulting a black man. For more, I reached out to journalist Catherine Field in Paris. Catherine, the revising of this law comes after quite a chaotic weekend in France. Can you give us an overview of what happened?
The main protest was on Saturday here in Paris. Some 46,000 people took to the streets to protest against this law and to protest against police brutality. It was again a setback for President Emmanuel Macron because the protests had actually been banned and a court overturned that ban the night before. So this whole group of 46,000 people came out. They were in the Place de la République. There was violence afterwards in which some 98 police officers were injured. 81 arrests were made. But again, we had instances of journalists being targeted by police. And in fact, one photographer was taken to hospital, was treated for injuries that he received during that time. There was also several large demonstrations in other major French cities, such as Lyon, Marseille. And there again, you're looking at a large number of people coming out onto the street and saying the government has got to back down, has got to relook this incredibly contentious law about publishing the images of police.
And this is quite a public backlash against this proposed law. What else is feeding into this popular outrage? Is it just the law itself?
No, it's not just the law itself. It's also the evidence that, you know, just within the last week, you've now got four instances of police alleged brutality. You've got the case of the black music producer who was beaten up in his studio by four police officers who are now under formal investigation. The judge has placed two of them behind bars during this investigation because he fears they could pressure witnesses. You also had the incident involving the migrant camp, which was dismantled in the center of Paris. And all this police violence was recorded. People had recorded it on their phone. So this new law would really have made it illegal to publish those images. Plus, there's this feeling that the French president is just dipping too far to the right. This is not what people want them to see. On top of that, they also feel that, you know, there's enough going on in the country at the moment with the economic downturn, with the lockdowns, with the prospect of more lockdowns over the Christmas New Year period, that he should be directing his attention elsewhere, perhaps even directing his attention to an upcoming law, which is going to be discussed in December, which is all about how do you curb radical Islamism in France. That is where most people feel he should be directing his attention towards.
And later this evening, the French Interior Minister, who is seen as quite supportive of the police, he will be questioned. What can we expect from that?
He will be questioned by the members of a special committee from the National Assembly, the lower house of parliament. He will be questioned about why he brought this bill in. And of course, he'll also be questioned about, is police violence a real problem? What is going on in the police force? And it will be difficult because everyone has seen these pictures, not just in the French media, on the front page of the papers, but it's gone viral on social media, not just in France, right across Europe.
That's journalist Catherine Fields in Paris. Catherine, thank you for joining us. This is VOA. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden will likely wear a protective boot for the next several weeks as he recovers from breaking his right foot while playing with one of his dogs, his doctor said. Biden suffered the injury Saturday and visited an orthopedist on Sunday afternoon, his office said. Biden's doctor said a CT scan found tiny fractures of two small bones in the middle of his right foot. Fractures are a concern generally as people age, but Biden's appears to be a relatively mild one based on his doctor's statement and the planned treatment. At 78, Biden will become the oldest U.S. president when he's inaugurated in January. He has often dismissed questions about his age during his campaign. The most prominent leaders of Thailand's anti-government protests presented themselves at a police station today to hear charges of insulting the country's monarchy, but they said they would not be deterred from their demonstrations. Seven protesters face royal insult charges. It is the first time in more than 2 years that anyone has been charged under Thailand's royal insult laws, which can mean jail sentences of up to 15 years. They and dozens of other protesters face other charges related to demonstrations held since July. The protests have become the biggest challenge to the monarchy in decades, as they have broken taboos by openly criticizing a monarchy which Thailand's constitution says must be revered. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. New Zealand's workplace regulator, WorkSafe, has filed charges against 13 parties following an investigation into a volcanic eruption on White Island in 2019, which killed 22 people. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
New Zealand's workplace regulator has charged 13 parties in its investigation into a deadly volcanic eruption last year. The parties were charged with not meeting health and safety standards and taking tourists to the White Island, or called Wakari in Maori, where the surprise eruption occurred. It killed 22 people and injured dozens more, mostly foreign tourists traveling on a cruise ship. At the time, questions were raised as to why people were allowed on the island, a popular destination for day trippers, given there was reportedly a heightened risk of an eruption. Bill Parks is chief executive of the workplace regulator, WorkSafe.
This deeply tragic event was unexpected, but that does not mean it was unforeseeable. After the largest and most complex investigation WorkSafe has ever undertaken, we have concluded that 13 parties did not meet their obligations and should face charges in court.
10 organizations were charged under the Health and Safety at Work Act, with each count carrying a maximum fine of over $1 million. And 3 individuals were charged with a maximum fine of $300,000. WorkSafe did not name those charged, but their first court appearance is set for December 15th.
That was Brian Wood of Reuters. The largest COVID-19 outbreak remains in the United States. The U.S. has averaged over 162,000 new cases and more than 1,400 deaths a day over the last week, a slight decline from the week before. Counties across the most populous U.S. state of California will begin stricter COVID-19 restrictions today as cases surge statewide. AP's Shelley Adler reports.
Los Angeles County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer on KNBC says they are very concerned about overwhelmed doctors and nurses.
Can we keep the healthcare workforce well enough and not overtaxed so that they can continue to provide the very excellent care they're all providing right now?
The Los Angeles County lockdown will close playgrounds, which parent Emma Gutierrez told KNBC she understands.
We've been keeping an eye on the numbers. I know that's starkly up. It just seems like the right thing to do is to go back to the safety measures.
Which calls for some 10 million residents to not gather with people outside their household for public or private occasions. I'm Shelley Adler.
That's it for our show today. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States was the first nation founded on a commitment to universal rights for all human beings. The most fundamental of these rights, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo during a speech in Indonesia, is the right to freedom of conscience, including religious freedom. America's respect for God-given rights is a defining feature of our national spirit, declared Secretary Pompeo.
It's why America stood tallest among Western democracies in supporting your independence from colonial rule and has been a stalwart supporter of Indonesia's transition to democracy over these past two decades. The fact that our people embrace freedom and uphold a tradition of tolerance is very special.
Embedded in Indonesia's vibrant democracy is a desire to see people of all faiths live together in harmony. This is reflected in its constitution, which clearly states that every person shall be free to practice the religion of his or her choice. As Secretary Pompeo said, there is literally no reason that Islam can't coexist peacefully alongside Christianity or Buddhism. Indonesia's traditional spirit of tolerance and pluralism must be nurtured now more than ever, said Secretary Pompeo.
Blasphemy accusations, which destroy lives, have become more common. Discrimination against non-official religions renders their practitioners second-class citizens who are subject to abuse and deprivation.
Secretary Pompeo went on to urge more religious leaders to speak out on behalf of people of all faiths, wherever their rights are being violated. We need more religious leaders to be a moral witness. One of those places is in Burma, where the military has violently oppressed Rohingya and other minorities. Indonesia has pushed ASEAN to live up to its humanitarian ideals, but progress on justice remains stalled, said Secretary Pompeo. But the gravest threat to the future of religious freedom, warned Secretary Pompeo, is the Chinese Communist Party's war against people of all faiths, Muslims, Buddhists, Christians, and Falun Gong practitioners alike. God-given, unalienable rights are the birthright of every people, said Secretary Pompeo. That's why free people of free nations must defend those rights.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.